This is Susan DeLatra, member of the Minneapolis Women's Theater called At the Foot of the Mountain. With me today is a group of women whose careers and interests are very different, as you'll notice when they introduce themselves. What has brought us together is a subject which in some way has touched the lives of us all, the subject of rape as violent assault and metaphor. I have asked the women here today to assist the theater in providing an ongoing discussion of rape. Before we begin, would each of you introduce yourself?
I'm Catherine McKinnon. I teach law and women's studies. I also practice law.
I'm Toni McNairn. I teach English at the University of Minnesota and am a lesbian feminist critic of literature in the world.
I'm Anita Brooks. I teach in Afro-American studies and women's studies, courses on the black woman and the black family. I consider myself a developmental psychologist.
I'm Nora Elson Sudia. I'm several times a rape victim, and I've spent many years making sense of that.
I'm Riv Ellen Prell. I'm an anthropologist at the University of Minnesota, interested in the cross-cultural study of women.
I'm Naomi Scheman. I teach philosophy and women's studies at the University of Minnesota. I teach courses mostly on the emotions, the nature of the self, and on sexuality.
I'm Phyllis Jane Rose, a performer and director at the Foot of the Mountain.
I'm Rosalie Wall, at the present time a member of the Minnesota Supreme Court. I'm a lawyer, I've been a law teacher, I've been a woman for 56 years. And during my early years as a lawyer, I represented defendants on the appellate level in rape cases.
I'm Lark DeHellen. I'm a student completing a degree in women, religion, and sexuality at the University of Minnesota. I have experienced rape and incest and speak from that background.
Thank you. Let's start off by looking at this question. How are women taught to be submissive and therefore easy targets for incest and assault?
I think one of the first things that women learn about ourselves as women is that to the extent we truly are women, that sexuality is something that's part of that definition, and that sex as a practice is something that we are taught men do to women. And so to the extent that we learn that identity, we learn to participate in something that is done to us. And rape is, I think, just an extreme example of that.
I think that that's really important, that, and it's come up a lot when I've been teaching courses on in sexuality and women's studies, that bringing together the Sleeping Beauty myth and what's supposed to happen in the latency period and developmentally, I've been thinking more and more of the latency period for women as not the temporary dormancy of our sexuality, but the absolute theft of it. And that if we develop the way we're supposed to in this culture, we never get our own authentic sexuality back again. We get a surrogate which is fobbed off on us when supposedly the Prince Charming comes and wakes us gently with a kiss. But whether it's gently with a kiss or brutally, it's another notion of sexuality that serves men, that's being foisted on us, and that we're supposed to accept as our own.
That makes me think about another set of early visual and verbal images, the Dick and Jane readers, which seemed to me wonderful training for victims, period. Because the thing that the women at Princeton found out when they studied those readers back at the very beginning of the new women's movement was not just that Jane was watching. I mean, we all knew they were going to find that out, right? Because we had been Jane. That Dick did it and Jane watched and occasionally applauded in the pictures. But what they found out in those pictures that terrified me was that the posture in which Jane was asked to watch most often, I think it was two-thirds of the time, was with her hands folded behind her back. And if I do that, my entire sexuality is exposed and I cannot get free at all. Police used to let people they were going to arrest put their hands above their heads on cars or buildings while they frisked them, but they lost too many strong people that way, because you can move your hands real fast if you're good from that position. They now have suspected arrestees put their hands behind their backs like Jane. And I was just appalled when I saw that. I was just literally being trained to take it
One of the things that we pick up very early, and I think it isn't just as some girls, as little girls, little boys, too, what it means to be a lady, and that you're supposed to be a lady. And I have constantly to be saying to my dear friends who are men, you know, call me a woman. I'm a woman, not a lady. And then I'm told, well, my mother taught me how to treat ladies. And I said, you know, the whole thing that's wrong with that is, I mean, and this was a very class concept. If you were a lady, a certain standard, you know, she stoops to conquer. I mean, this applied. Mm-hmm. If you didn't happen to qualify to be a lady, anything went, and you could be treated mm-hmm. in any way.
It's also a very racist concept, usually.
Mm-hmm. The double bind that the black woman sometimes finds herself in, and being taught that she is responsible for the sexuality or the sexual behavior of males, and it's the way she carries herself, or that she is the responsible for his satisfaction even. And she is not a woman unless she can satisfy the man. So that it's a double bind. She is taught at the same time in this ladylike role, which is directly contradictory, and that somehow she would be protected by men, but there are very few men that will protect the black woman. And I think this is very evident in the law. At one time, it was not even possible to rape a black woman. That by definition, she was the prostitute. And there are three categories, the virgin, the wife, and the prostitute, and she didn't fit any of the other two. So she gets a double whammy both ways.
Negroes for sale. A young girl about 20 years of age and her two female children, one 4 and the other 2 years old, is remarkably strong and healthy, never having had a day's sickness with the exception of smallpox in her life. The children are fine and healthy. She is very prolific in her generating qualities and affords a rare opportunity for any person wishing to raise a strong and healthy family of servants for their own use. Any person wishing to purchase, leave your address at the South Carolina Mercury office.
One of the interesting things to consider in this process is not only Dick and Jane or what we learn in our socialization, but the kinds of myths that define our entire culture. And to take a slightly different tack, it's useful to look at a myth of an Amazonian Indian group called the Munduraku in a study of them that I use often when I teach. In the society, rape is very prevalent. It's a complete norm in the society. And the conditions of rape are that if a woman is ever alone, she can be a target for rape. There's no sanction against that. That's completely appropriate. Even with modernization, there was an example of a girl who ran away from school, and for that she was gang raped. This isn't just rape, this is gang raped. People's brothers and fathers stand by and watch that happen. Now, the reason that the people who wrote this book, the Murphys, argue that this is so prevalent is because the myths of origin in this people tell the story that women were once powerful. They controlled the religious objects, the sacred pipes. They lived in the house where you worshiped the gods. And one day, because of a problem, and that's always why women lose powers, they do something wrong, the men were able to take the sacred pipes away. And after that, women now, whenever that religious event happens, stand sheltered, hidden with little children, and they wail for their loss of the pipes, but they're never allowed to see them again. The Murphys argue that men are so terrified that women will take those pipes back that they organize their lives around keeping women down. So the point isn't what women learn in their culture to become submissive, but what do men learn that make them so terrified of women?
How do the women in that study report feeling about being raped, or are they asked about that?
Well, of course, the anthropologists never ask that question, but what the Murphys do argue, very interestingly, and they consider this a feminist book, is that women don't take that religion seriously, that they go through the motions of crying, but they don't really miss that, and instead they have a very rich life with one another because they are each other's protection. Because it's only with other women that you are free of men. And so they have an interesting example in which men and women are both asked who owns the house, and each one of them says, I do. So they argue for a two parallel societies existing within one society, one a women's society and one a men's society. And that, of course, is a complete defiance of any anthropological notion of culture, which is that we all have it, but men control it.
Is it part of the rules of that particular society that it's only when you're alone that you can be raped, that even being with one other woman, that you're safe? Is that the
yes.
rule, or is it that they will use force upon you no matter
no.
whether you're alone?
Even with one other woman, you're safe. In fact, in answer to what you were saying, Kitty, the sense is that to some extent women say, well, you only get raped if you're stupid enough to be by yourself. So that women are always there for one another. There is some blaming. What was so sad for me was the realization that rape could even be used against the smallest assertion of will in a girl who ran away from a colonizing society back to her own people. But she disobeyed, and that was enough.
Well, in our society, then, what sorts of lives are available to women who have refused to be submissive?
Well, Foot of the Mountain showed a prime example in Calamity Jane. I mean, you became an outlaw, practically speaking.
I think that it's very hard to get past the stories that we're brought up on, that if you go against your male protector, if you assert yourself and go on, then you're going to be alone and unhappy and bitter and ugly. And I think it's hard for us as women to get past that early training that that's what's going to happen. It's hard for us to see something beyond that. It's hard for me to see beyond that, as well as acknowledging that in some respect society does that to me. As I say, I have been hurt by my protectors, then those protectors then disown me and I am alone. And I haven't been taught how to make any new connections.
You're saying you hadn't been taught lets me know, Lark, how I'm feeling when you're saying that is, as a teacher who was first a student, one of the things about the women who chose not to made up in a heterosexual way is we don't know much about them. So that I think the problem is it really is a like reinventing the wheel. It's like every girl nearing some age where something has to be decided. It's like until fairly recently with women's studies, feminist studies, lesbian studies, whatever, the lives of those women who refused the kind of you protect me mm-hmm. were underground. And so it's like I didn't have any other examples. Or if I did, they sure were played down. And so that's another way it's then harder for me as an individual to go ahead and make that choice, is not only do I not see anything in my literal world, but I don't have anything for resonance from history or literature or culture or anything.
And from the rib which the Lord had taken from man, made he a woman, and brought her unto man. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones, and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man.
One of the reasons that I was so surprised when you were speaking about that other culture, that a woman would not be raped if she were with other women, I don't understand why in that society it's not seen as even more threatening. That is, it's the beginning of the reclamation of women's lost power to be with other women. So, and what happens in this society, at least, is that one thing women can do who refuse to be submissive is, in fact, and do, be with other women. And that itself is seen as a provocation to rape.
At the foot of the mountain, we set up a essentially separatist space where we as women could work together without concern for male values. And when we're within that space, it's exactly what you're talking about in terms of having the support and the beginning of reclamation of our spirits. However, we exist in this culture, and every time we reach out beyond the space, we're confronted with theater reviews, for example, is what came to mind when we are attacked by virtue of our identity, and any value we state in any tone of voice is always seen as strident, is always seen as raucous, angry, etc. So that we're never seen, really. We're only seen as that group of rebels. Personally, I guess I, when you said that about Calamity Jane and what are the options in this culture, I feel like an outlaw. Even though I feel safe at the foot of the mountain, any moment I step out, something deep within me feels like an outlaw. And although as a child, even then I fought what I thought was shameful behavior in my sisters, being groomed for Barbie doll heaven, nevertheless, almost equal is the my own shame that I would never acknowledge, that I wasn't like that, the shame of being unacceptable.
That reminds me, when I was raped the first time when I was 13, where I was just beginning to, you know, learn to make out and all of that nonsense. And I think the word outlaw is absolutely appropriate. What I noticed among my friends who were all learning how to be heterosexual and so on was, you know, laws, systems, you know, whatever, and that the analogy between my own rape and what my friends were learning to do was way too clear. It was way too much there. And I thought I thought they were learning to get raped a lot, and I thought that dates looked a lot like rapes and so on, and that I would choose to not be part of that. I mean, that was, you know, I think that outlaw is absolutely appropriate word.
This was an arranged date. My mother had arranged it with his aunt. He was an intern at NYU med school, and he asked me if I wanted to see where he lived before we had dinner. We got to his room, and he threw me on the bed and raped me, just like that. I thought to myself, I wonder what happens now. I kept thinking about my mother. She'd never believe it. I'll tell you what happened next. We went out to have dinner as if nothing had happened.
I don't personally identify, you know, with being an outlaw. I mean, I know that this is true of very many women, but in my experience of growing up, I very early identified with a sense of my own being and who I was, because it happened that when I was 3, my mother died, and my little brother and my 2 older sisters and I went to live with my grandparents. And then it happened that a few years later, my grandfather and little brother were killed, and I lived with my grandmother, and an aunt was the other significant person in this. So I didn't have a close primary family, but I lived with the grandmother, and my Aunt Sarah was a very significant person to me, who was out in the world doing what needed to be done. And so I saw women doing this, and I never questioned it. I mean, it was a part of life. And so I was free to be who I wanted to be and do what I wanted to do, and I just never thought that it was wrong to do otherwise. And I feel very fortunate.
I envy your ability to have that role model so early in your life. That's something that I have looked at other women around me who have found that, and that's not the case with most of my friends or with my own life. I remember just a few months ago being told by my mother that she was real concerned that I was going to college. Men don't like smart women, and couldn't I at least act dumb? And I remember, as I was growing up, being told that I wasn't to run, and I wasn't to climb trees. I was supposed to look nice all the time, to smile nice. If I didn't smile, I was insulting the men in authority over me. I should never go out in public and frown, because that hurts the men, and I'm to take care of the men. I am real angry that I was taught that.
Advice from Maribel Morgan.
Eat by candlelight, and you'll light up his candle.
Seduce him under the dining room table. Call him at the office and tell him you crave his body.
Wear something frilly and feminine. You know, lacy, transparent, or pink.
It's okay to be a bunny.
Wrap your naked self in cellophane as a surprise package for him.
Write out a list of his faults and a list of his virtues and throw away the list of his faults.
Your body belongs to your husband.
Follow these total woman principles, and the flame of his love will leap up for you.
It was interesting in my experience as a child that I had the negative experience of having a mother who was really very much role-oriented. But the thing that really helped me was to find a woman in the community that became my mentor. And she encouraged me to be a rebel. Whereas my mother, I would get, you know, beatings for being the rebel. So that I found it very, very important, and I see it now, for young women to have mentors. And when they don't have that support within the family, that it is there in the community, and that being a rebel can really be exciting, and I have found that role even now to be very, very exciting.
Let me add a word for motherhood. Having an infant now, I find myself thinking about this question in a very different way, because I, like obviously everyone in this room, I too was a kind of a rebel with ambivalence about that, but ultimately as I grew older felt that was the best thing in the world to be. Now with my own daughter, I find myself amazed at my anxiety about pushing her into the rebel role. Mm-hmm. And I feel a responsibility, and I think this may be one of the difficulties of being a heterosexual woman, is that one is constantly, one gets the prizes for being in the mainstream, but one pays prices if one is an autonomous woman, a feminist, feeling, is this making my husband look foolish? Am I hurting my child? In some ways, these things seem very trivial, but they're very painful, mm-hmm. because I think about, well, some of the greatest feminists in this country have daughters who hate feminism. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of responsibility that one is willing to take for oneself, but despite all one's best cognitive impulses, there's great fear about perhaps about the memories of being a rebel and not wanting to hurt one's child, even if you know that developed your character.
Mm. How does that relate to the phenomenon of rape?
As you show in the play, mothers persuading their daughters not to prosecute.
I didn't want to report it to my husband, and I never did report it to the police.
For years afterwards, I thought it was my fault.
I was only a child.
What do you want me to do? Be angry and hate all men?
My parents didn't prosecute because they were neighborhood boys. Instead, they sent me into analysis.
I'm about to write something about being a migratory lesbian. The first sentence is something like, I began to leave the South when I was 4. And I think that's true. And part of leaving the South was not submitting. Because in the South, all the messages were clearer. They weren't essentially different from Minnesota, but they were neon messages. I was taught to faint in 1943. How to do that without hurting myself. Now, I turned it into how to take calisthenics and do mat work. Because I wasn't scared to tumble. But my mother, with the best intentions in the world, taught me to faint and taught me when to put my eyes down with a male, how long to keep them there, and how to bring them up so that he couldn't resist a single question that I asked him, most of which were economic. So she really was trying to help me be secure. But what because I was taught to be passive in a super way, and because I wouldn't do that, but I had no role models of women being active, my rebellion, I now know after years of therapy, was mostly counterproductive. Mm-hmm. So much of my rebellion hurt me. It's like I knew how to oppose all the male authorities, but then they could keep me from doing a lot of things that I wanted to do as an independent woman. I think about my history at the University of Minnesota. I helped the male professors there, who dislike me so now, dislike me, by being radical and, you know, a rebel, but sometimes against myself and in ways that didn't make any sense. And I now am quite radical and a rebel, but I have a very nice time working there. And so there's some way that was different, and now it feels self-affirming. Then it just felt like beating my way out of a cage. That's what it felt like. And any bird you watch beating its way out of the cage dies. I mean, if it's not careful, all the wings go away.
I would like to say that as a person trying to respect myself and stop the messages that I was trained in, the hardest thing, remembering, was terrible and painful. This discussion is painful and hurts. But the thing that I fought the hardest was having to take responsibility for that remembering, having to take the responsibility to find a remedy, to say to my brother's wife, "I'm afraid for your daughter," and to follow that up, to provide the remedy, to take responsibility. I think that's the hardest part.
Susan B. Anthony, summer, 1870.
While I do not pray for anybody to commit outrages, still I do pray for some terrific shock that will startle the women of this nation into a self-respect, that will force them to break their yoke of bondage and give them faith in themselves, which will enable them to see that man can no more feel, speak, or act for woman than could the old slaveholder for his slave. The fact is, women are in chains, and their servitude is all the more debasing because they do not realize it. Oh, to compel them to speak and act for their own freedom, though they face the scorn and contempt of all the world for doing it.
At the Foot of the Mountain is a women's theater company located in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The women who performed in the theater's production About Rape were Kay Bolstad, Susan DeLatra, Rhonda Downs, Marianne Keller, and Teresa Ziegler. Material for the production was compiled by Martha Bozen. This program was made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This is Susan DeLatra, member of the Minneapolis Women's Theater called At the Foot of the Mountain. With me today is a group of women whose careers and interests are very different, as you'll notice when they introduce themselves. What has brought us together is a subject which in some way has touched the lives of us all, the subject of rape as violent assault and metaphor. I have asked the women here today to assist the theater in providing an ongoing discussion of rape. Before we begin, would each of you introduce yourself?
I'm Catherine McKinnon. I teach law and women's studies. I also practice law.
I'm Toni McNairn. I teach English at the University of Minnesota and am a lesbian feminist critic of literature in the world.
I'm Anita Brooks. I teach in Afro-American studies and women's studies, courses on the black woman and the black family, I consider myself a developmental psychologist.
I'm Nora Elson Sudia. I'm several times a rape victim, and I've spent many years making sense of that.
I'm Riv Ellen Prell. I'm an anthropologist at the University of Minnesota, interested in the cross-cultural study of women.
I'm Naomi Scheman. I teach philosophy and women's studies at the University of Minnesota. I teach courses mostly on the emotions, the nature of the self, and on sexuality.
I'm Phyllis Jane Rose, a performer and director at the Foot of the Mountain.
I'm Rosalie Wall. At the present time, a member of the Minnesota Supreme Court. I'm a lawyer. I've been a law teacher. I've been a woman for 56 years. And during my early years as a lawyer, I represented defendants on the appellate level in rape cases.
I'm Lark DeHellen. I'm a student completing a degree in women, religion, and sexuality at the University of Minnesota. I have experienced rape and incest and speak from that background.
Thank you. Let's start off by looking at this question. What sorts of lives are available to women who have refused to be submissive?
The ways in which I've internalized so many of the sanctions for independence, I've been extraordinarily lucky in my life in having a mother in particular, but parents who had ambitions for me and pushed me to do what I could do and had supportive teachers and went to a women's college and so on. And so in most of those ways, the world has been reasonably helpful. But I find myself running like a subtext through this life are fantasies of being struck down. And I think that there are two components to it. One is, how dare I, and I'm going to be punished, punished for my independence, and that it's going to come in some magical way, mostly has to do with automobiles, because I haven't been punished so far, and it's almost as though my success and the support that I've gotten has got to be an anomaly, there's got to be something wrong, and I'm going to be struck down. And the other side of it is that as long as I'm not struck down, as long as I'm reasonably powerful and taking charge of my life and successful, nobody's going to love me. That it's only after I've been struck down and am lying there unconscious that anybody is going to love me. And this tremendous deep incompatibility between that I think many women feel between being successful, being reasonably powerful, and being loved.
The need for love, or the need to be loved, I think entraps women. The, you know, perceiving that, you know, there's a great big love out there and I really have to get it. And if I don't get it, then somehow I'm going to be ignored, a nobody, etc., etc. And the self-love really is the most fulfilling love. And that dependency, you know, love for intimacy, that I think entraps us into all of these other, you know, behaviors. We need love. We got to have that love out there. And that I think is really something that's really dangerous.
I was also struck by what you said, Naomi, in terms of the relationship between violence against your person and the acquisition of love. That again is the rape model. And there's a notion that the structure of what you were saying is that you would violate some rules that you were given as a person. There would then be violence against your person, and that would be then related to love. Is very much like scenarios that are explicitly acted out, say, in S&M scenes. And what goes on in that situation is that the sort of that what is taken to be both erotic from a sexual standpoint and affirming to what it is women want is to break some kind of rules, then either, you know, be spanked, be beaten, be in some way violated, and then comforted. Or that in fact, the violation is the expression of what it is to love, the true nature of a woman, since in that, of course, is the message of pornography. You know, that what it is, you know, what we most want, and therefore what is going to make us most feel loved, is to be degraded
and humiliated. And so, you know, what I sense in that is the way in which, in a way that is to me totally non-Freudian, that structure of what you're saying about your life is sexual. And the other thing that I think is significant about what we talk about when we're asked how we learn submission, therefore how we set ourselves up for rape, what do we all talk about? We all talk about what we learn about our sexuality. And I think there's a great deal of talk going on these days that rape is not sexual, it's violent. And I think that's wrong. I think that violence in many ways is sexual, and that something that women who are violated by rape learn is that it is an expression of what we've learned as, you know, as part of our sex role behavior, and that what it affects in terms of our own identity and our behavior and everything that follows from that is intricately tied up with and in fact identical with our sexuality.
Something else about getting hit by a car and being found and loved is I had that almost same fantasy all through my adolescence, but with an interesting little twist, which is that I went through getting raped repeatedly, and what, you know, was trying to recover from just the physical pain kind of stuff, and also to be a strong person anyway. And I very much wanted people to understand how hard it was. And so I had a fantasy like that of somebody, you know, suddenly realizing that, my God, Nora is absolutely incredible to have lived through that, you know. And it had very much to do with, you know, getting found with all my bruises, you know, and having people go, my God, you know, rape is, you know, is really that bad or whatever.
In fact, looking for a way that someone could recognize that you were injured.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, the need to be loved is something that we all have, you know, whether we're men or women, and I think that we always are trying to fulfill that, and we've identified it, you know, with the sexual act, because actually we know from experience that one of the highest expressions of love is through sexual union. We've been taught that, and I don't know about the Old Testament tradition, but in the New Testament tradition, repeatedly the image is used of Christ and his church, and it's a sexual image, and it's used. I mean, Kitty, I think I'm not coming down in exactly the same place you are. To me, rape is not an act of sex. I mean, it's not just another way to do intercourse. It is an act of violence in the way that will most degrade the woman, and it's done, or whoever's raped, and it's done by somebody who's utterly angry and is expressing this anger in a way that will be most degrading.
I don't so much mean to disagree with that as a definition of rape, as I mean to try to look at women's ordinary experiences of heterosexual intercourse. And I find often difficulty distinguishing those, even when you express it in that way. Often anger is seen as a stimulus to erotic expression. You know, in terms of the way battery occurs often, I mean, women are beaten up, and then they make up by having heterosexual intercourse. What often that is a continuation of the expression of his anger and her submission. So I'm saying it's just, when you inquire, I think, into many, many, many women's ordinary expressions, ordinary experiences of what happens to them in heterosexual relationships, it becomes difficult, I think, to distinguish any of the values or the emotions or the relationships that occur in a rape context from those experiences. That's all I'm saying.
I would like to go back to what Naomi was saying about our concept of love, which really isn't back. It's where you were too,
right,
Kitty. And go back to my feelings as a child experiencing sexual assault within my home with the men who loved me. They said they loved me and were doing this because they loved me, because I didn't like it. I was wicked to not love them enough to like it. So therefore, I had to build my sexuality in order to be able to love them and love what they were doing. And as I did that, I proved myself the whore and the prostitute that is unlovable. So by doing what I was being taught would make me lovable, I was proving myself unlovable. And I don't think that's an experience that's isolated to women who experience overt incest in their home.
And you really learn that to be loved is to be violated.
I can't think of anything that benefits more from a feminist analysis than rape, because you can convince yourself that with socialism, that kind of economic exploitation will stop. You can convince yourself that given an egalitarian system, people won't treat each other badly. But one of the virtues of rape as a teaching device is that there is nothing that explains rape other than male-female relationships, because it exists cross-culturally, it exists across all kinds of class systems. It's so pervasive, and the only way you can understand it is by understanding the nature, the potential nature of patriarchy, which exists everywhere, because we don't know any examples of matriarchy cross-culturally. We know some subtle examples, we know some places where women have been more or less powerful, but there are no examples that we know in which women, in the mythological sense that we spin out, were the people in control in a society formally. And what do you know? We find that rape exists everywhere.
See, I don't think we have cross-cultural studies of rape.
No,
and
we don't.
I haven't been able to find them. And
for very interesting reasons.
I think that's
reasons.
Crucial, because rape, what's the difference between rape and intercourse? It's the difference between that which women will put up with and that which women feel violated by. Mm-hmm. Because I think that in a lot of ways, rape is a question of consciousness. It's not a question of the specific behaviors of the man involved. And...
Well, I know heterosexual friends of mine who say...
I have never been raped.
Yeah, and that...
And
but,
you say...
But, no. I have some heterosexual friends who say something else. Yeah. They say, until about 4 years ago, or 3 years ago, or 2 months ago, or yesterday, I thought we were making love. Mm-hmm. And now I've taken Women's Studies 1001 or something, gone to a law conference... And now I'm amazed. I don't think that's true. I think he's raping me.
Right. What it means is she has
a different
sense.
And that's her consciousness change.
She has a different sense of herself.
Because the guy's therefore, doing the same thing.
Right. Therefore, what it is to violate her sense of herself. That's why I want a cross-cultural study of rape. Because I think our sense of ourselves are those things which we are culturally given and also those things which we struggle against as the people we have been culturally made.
I think that's been one of the most important things to come out of this wave of feminism is a lot of very conscious attention paid to the power and the importance of naming and the need to have women involved in a collective process of naming, renaming, and for the first time properly naming, that I think it's possible to talk of discovery here, not just a change that what was not rape before becomes rape, but a discovery that it was rape, and a discovery that one was hiding from oneself the recognition that it was rape. A woman about 10 years younger than I am, in her mid-20s, was in my office the other day talking about having spent a period of months talking with a large group of women friends, and one by one, each of them acknowledging that she had been raped. And it wasn't just that it had been a secret from other people, but none of those women had ever acknowledged to herself before that she had been raped and that that was rape. And our lives just change utterly when we, for the first time, discover the proper names for things.
I would like to speak to that in a way, in that I guess I'm agreeing with Naomi in the sense of discovery. And I'd like to speak to having been raped, which is the same as remembering the incest and naming it. I didn't think I had been raped until 9 months ago, maybe less. And I remember it. I was standing in the shower, I think, in the shower. It's a great place. And I was going to give a talk on sexual assault. And I was thinking, I really feel an empathy for rape victims. but I believe that empathy comes from experience. Why do I feel this empathy? And I started thinking back, and I thought back to when I first experienced intercourse. And I was 14 at a Bible camp. And it was the evangelist's son. And I got in the car, and I smiled at him. And so I have always thought about that terrible thing that I did on that day. I never talked about it. I had never told anyone, because I smiled. I got in the car. But that didn't change the fact that on that day I was raped. I remembered. I have a friend that tells me that the main thing that women need to do is remember.
I'd like to think of another way of putting what you said, Kitty. I think it's interesting to look at the continuity between intercourse and rape, but I think there's another way of putting it, which interestingly, men talk about recognizing their capacity to be a rapist, and that you have become a feminist in some way as a male when you have understood that all men can be rapists, that there is in your own behavior the things we've talked about of aggressiveness or pushing a woman a little farther than she wants to go. I think what all of this speaks to, which was part of the sort of psychological revolution that Freud brought along, is the realization that we are all capable of being raped, because we can only not convict the men who rape our daughters or look away from rape when we say that only happens to girls that aren't nice. It's only when we understand that we all share a state or an experience that we can really talk about revolutionizing rape laws or our cultural attitudes or whatever. So it's not only that there is that continuity between one kind of an act, which is more or less violent, and another kind, but the realization that every one of us, no matter how good or at Bible camp or how nice or how long we wear our skirts or where we spend our time or what we do at night, that can happen to every one of us.
Ruth Ellen, when you began to speak about the way in which we all can be raped or can be rapists, if we tried then to imagine a culture in which rape were not possible, what would it be like, and what would we have to do to make that possible?
I think that women would have to be equal to men throughout the society and in every way. And one of the things that I'm a little uneasy about talking about the capacity for each man to be a rapist and the capacity of each woman to be raped, which I think doesn't take away from its truth, is that it allows each person who is listening to disidentify with it. That is, oh, of course I'm capable of it, but I never have. And you know, maybe it's a step, but yeah, I think it doesn't, it allows for example, I think that almost all men can read Susan Brown Miller's book, Against Our Will, and never think that they were and are, in fact, at the moment, rapists.
But that means that they haven't acknowledged that. To say,
I think they can acknowledge their capacity without acknowledging that they do it.
I think you'd be surprised at how unwilling. I once asked a colleague of mine when I first became aware of this, a very together person who I'm sure would say he was a feminist, and I said, well, tell me, you know, do you think you could rape? And he said, not unless I was provoked.
And then you have to ask him what a provocation would be.
But that's the point. The point is he couldn't identify. He couldn't identify with that.
Okay,
that part
that,
of himself.
That it is a lot
I don't
easier
think we
to
disagree.
Identify with one's capacity than it is to identify what one actually is doing as part of a continuum. That's why I'm interested in talking about seeing the rape in intercourse.
Susan, I'm afraid the only place is as a person who reads and teaches books. Well, I'm not afraid. I'm interested that the only works that I can think of in which rape didn't either exist or be there by implication are feminist utopias. I think of Her Land.
I think particularly of Fatigue's Les Guerrières, which does deal with, I mean, in her land, they've learned to have children themselves, which seems to me very far advanced. But in Les Guerrières, there is still the need for procreation by males. And not only are women equal to men there, but women admit the first man back into the culture. I mean, there's, and the metaphor of that is fascinating to me in that book, because, I mean, the women go apart from the men and fight them and clearly are wonderful, and then figure out on what grounds males will be readmissible. And when I try to think about ordering my own personal life, that's what I've done. Now, I can't extend that a minute past my own personal life, but I am in the process of doing that. I mean, I pulled away entirely as a separatist, fought, and now I'm saying which men can speak to me, can have lunch with me, can sit in my office, can come into my house. It's a tiny number, and they're very precious, but they have to qualify constantly. And they know that because I've told them that. And it's wearing.
Here's another perhaps surprising thing that I think would have to be part of a society in which there would be no rape, a sort of egalitarian paradise. And that would be a tremendous amount of information about one's body, about sexuality, about one's own sexuality. There is a peasant society in Guatemala in which at the time women give birth, they do not know what is happening to them. They do not know what intercourse is. And one of the painful and difficult parts of that society is that mothers inflict that on their daughters. People argue because it is that information that is the only power a woman has in the society. When she becomes aware of her menstrual blood, men fear menstrual blood so much and are so frightened that a woman will leak it into their soup, that controlling who knows what menstrual blood is and how it works is the only power available to these Guatemalan peasants. And so in a women's studies class I taught, where we tried to come up with an ideal society, also a worst possible society, it was a free and widespread access to knowledge about one's own body, which we are all in some peculiar ways often deprived of, as men and women. In fact, in treatment of rapists, one of the revolutionary things that they do, if you're in a state that's lucky enough to even have some kind of program for offenders, is they just educate them about what bodies are and what women might want, because rapists, on the whole, people, psychologists who've done study of them, find them abysmally ignorant about who women are, what their sexuality is, and it's what allows the kind of horrendous fantasies fed on by pornographers.
Such a society would also be founded on the radical thought that no one has the right to have or exercise any power over any other person, which is why my face turned checkerboard probably when you said that rape becomes rape when the victim becomes outraged. I understand what you're saying about personal discovery and think that's crucial, but it's also crucial that I, who hear a child screaming back behind the alley behind my house, need to take responsibility to protect that child, because the kid, of course, loves her parents, even though she's being battered often. That was my confusion on that point. I was reading a biography written for adolescents about Emma Goldman, in which the second paragraph, which began talking about Emma as a radical, defined radical from the Latin radix, meaning root, to get to the root of, and I think I use that definition of radical to keep my sanity in the middle of those compassionate dilemmas that women face themselves with, so that whenever I get confused in my compassion for our whole culture, I remember simply it is wrong for someone to hurt another person. It is wrong for someone to have power over another person. And I sometimes have to be that simplistic and insistent in my life to survive and clarify my feelings.
I think there's some real difficult problems in a lot of that we got to see as problems, though. Namely, to ask a question about incest that people always ask about rape, particularly when one talks about its commonalities with intercourse, is it ever possible for a child to have anything that we would conceive of as a sexual exchange with a parent in which that child is not hurt. In the law, you have a simplistic solution to a lot of difficulties about children by fixing an age of consent at a particular age. I mean, I think that's a proxy for answering in some profound way the question that I asked, which the law often does. That is, you can't really answer these things, so you fix some hard line about it and then proceed to use that by asking, can a child ever experience love in a way that adults would conceive of as sexual and not be in the position of being exploited, either within the family or with an adult outside the family, to me is not a simple question. And the fact that power is seen to correlate with age makes it seem easier in that context. I think power is not seen to correlate with gender, simply, in this society, although I think it does. Therefore, it's a lot easier for people to look at something like intercourse and say, there is that intercourse in which a woman is not violated. We consider her someone who wants that. She is able to consent to it. What would a society look like in which there is no rape? The only answer I can have is that women and men would be totally, socially, in every respect, equal.
But the use of power and of oppressing with power is something that no matter what our sex is, if we're in control, you know, we may do violence to another person, you know, whatever their sex. And all of the guilt feelings that we have, women have them, men also have them. Where do we go with those of us, whatever our sex, who don't want to do that to other people without making people feel like an outlaw on either side of the line?
That's, of course, the great challenge. And to throw that back on each of us is horrifying, that I myself have to do something about that is both exhilarating and horrifying. And of course, that's hopefully the challenge that the men will receive. Some don't receive that challenge. If they really see what has happened, it's of course their option and hopefully choice to then change their own personal behavior, which is where any change and any revolution happens.
I would like to say that as a person trying to respect myself and stop the messages that I was trained in, the hardest thing, remembering, was terrible and painful. This discussion is painful and hurts. But the thing that I fought the hardest was having to take responsibility for that remembering, having to take the responsibility to find a remedy, to say to my brother's wife, I'm afraid for your daughter, and to follow that up, to provide the remedy, to take responsibility. I think that's the hardest part.
At the Foot of the Mountain is a woman's theater company located in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This program was made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission.